What you are about to hear is not.
Not
a podcast. This is a global conversation recorded live in real time with real people.
Journalists.
Business leaders.
Academics. Politicians. I think the term's a deep state.
Oh dear.
Investors.
Experts. Diplomats.
Citizens.
Coming together from around the world to share their views and ask our guests the questions. If you would like to join this conversation or hear our incredible library of past conversations, please visit our website, pm101.club, and join the fastest growing conscious community on the free internet. Thanks for being here.
Enjoy
the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to Politics and Media 101, the place where we hear live and direct from people in the news, in their own voices, in their own words, in real time, in long form. And where anyone who wants to can join to ask them a question, share their thoughts, or just listen. I'm Jeff Browning, and we're grateful to you for joining us. Today, we're very excited to release part of a conversation, interview, and audience Q&A we had with Congressman Ro Khanna of California. In 1945, 2 months after the end of World War II, a government administrator and engineer named Vannevar Bush submitted a report to President Truman where he said that science was the endless frontier, that basic research in science was the pacemaker of technological progress, and that society depended on the government to fund this basic research. His argument was essentially that new products and processes don't appear fully grown. They're founded on new principles and conceptions that are painstakingly developed. In the time since 1945, scientific research and development has been at the absolute core of what makes America a prosperous place. Our technological and scientific advantages have played a key role in our foreign policy and our place in the world. Many things in our lives, from the internet to Velcro, were born in labs that we all as taxpayers funded together to propel humanity and the country forward. And while the U.S. government did literally invent the internet, other countries have invested hundreds of billions of dollars into trying to copy, replicate, and build on our success. In some cases, stealing science directly from labs and companies. In order to maintain this edge, the U.S. needs to continue these investments and this entrepreneurial spirit. Congressman Khanna is the leading proponent of this idea in Congress, and he's introduced bipartisan legislation, the Endless Frontier Act, named after the report that Vannevar Bush gave to President Truman in 1945 that seeks to propel us forward with investments in this area. It was an incredible conversation about the leading edge of science and geopolitics, and we hope you enjoy it as much as we did. As always, if you like or dislike what you hear, if you want to find out how to join us live almost every day of the week, maybe ask one of our upcoming guests a question, or hear past episodes, please visit our website, pm101.live or pm101.club. They both work and will get you to the same place where you can find all that and more. Without any further ado, let's roll the tape. Congressman, good to see you. Welcome, sir.
Hi.
Welcome.
Good to be on.
Thank you for being here. So everyone, we're here. This is Politics and Media 101. We have Congressman Ro Khanna from California. It's wonderful to have you here. We appreciate it. So I understand you literally just came from the White House. You were there today when President Biden was signing the infrastructure bill. So I would be interested to know, what is that like? You know, we see these events on TV, but when you're there at the White House, you know, what do you do? Do you stand around and shake hands? What other kind of stuff goes on? It's been a trying few months for Democrats. So what was the atmosphere like there today?
Well, it was a great event. I thought the person who introduced President Biden, other than the president, had the best speech. And she talked about having been incarcerated and then getting a union job and what this would mean for her. And she said she would never have guessed that one day she'd be introducing the president of the United States. And yet there she was because of the possibility of America. And she got a standing ovation. But it's, you know, they're all the members of Congress. About 100 of us were there. And about 20 senators, governors, mayors. It was very, very cold, so you had to brave the cold. But it was a great event. And, you know, no matter how long you're in politics, I think very few people are jaded enough not to be awed by the White House and getting invited there. And when the president works the rope line, so, you know, you have every member of Congress packed up, you know, trying to get to shake the president's hand. So it's like any like you would expect any person to be.
So I want to get right into it and talk about some legislative impacts here. You are a key proponent of a bill called the Endless Frontiers Act, which a lot of people may not know is named after a report that Vannevar Bush gave to Congress in 1945, saying that federal support for technology and innovation in the Cold War era would be critical. So I would love to hear from you. How did, in your view, how did the U.S.'s technological advantage shape outcomes in Cold War competition with the USSR?
You're absolutely right. Vannevar Bush basically goes to Roosevelt and says the reason we won World War II was our technology advantage. And what we need to do is double down on scientific research to win the 20th century and to lead in the Cold War. And Roosevelt and our country listens to his strategy. And as a result, we fund not just applied science, we fund theoretical science largely at the most elite universities. And this leads to America having a competitive advantage. And especially post Sputnik, the launch of Sputnik in 57, we even doubled down, largest investment in science and technology in the 60s. And it gives us not just a military edge, but it leads to things like the development of the internet, the development of GPS, and GPS is actually America's gift to the world. Both Presidents Reagan and Clinton say, we're going to make GPS available to the entire world without charging them. So now we get to the present time where the science and technology research is no longer the robust part of our GDP. And this bill would be the largest increase in science and technology investment since the Cold War. But unlike Vannevar Bush, we say now you don't just have to put the money in MIT or Stanford. You can actually put the money across the country and create tech centers and tech hubs and where there are research universities in the Midwest and South. So it's far more geographically distributed. And there's also an applied technology component, not just theoretical science. And that's basically what the Endless Frontiers Bill does.
So looking at where we are right now in the U.S., are there sectors where you feel that the U.S. is losing its technological edge? And what do you think the world would look like if another country like China were to become the undisputed leader in some of these fields?
Well, I wouldn't say we're losing, but there are places where we need to do more to make sure we stay ahead. We have certainly fallen behind in semiconductor manufacturing. We do a lot of the design work here, but the mass semiconductor manufacturing, volume manufacturing is taking place in Taiwan and South Korea. And that's a problem, especially given the situation with China and Taiwan. We don't want to be dependent. So the bill has a big provision for semiconductor manufacturing, especially given the CHIPS Act now as part of the effort, which would have a fund for semiconductor manufacturing in the United States. In AI, there are places in AI we're leading, but there are other places where China has done quite well, and the funding in China is dwarfing ours. We have a lot of private sector funding, but not nearly as much federal funding. This would close that gap and give us a chance to lead in AI and develop AI that doesn't require as much data, because data-dependent AI is an advantage for China. A third area is clean technology. I mean, China is leading in electric vehicle manufacturing. China is leading right now in some of the other energy output, clean energy output. And this would give America a chance to establish leadership there. So those are three areas where we're focused.
And it's a timely moment for us to have this conversation again, because not only were you at the White House earlier today, but President Biden is having a virtual meeting today with President Xi Jinping. And on the call, I know that he plans to talk about the new infrastructure bill, but there's also an expectation that trade issues will be a big subject of the meeting. As you know, the U.S.-China trade relationship is acrimonious, we could say. So I'd be interested to know, how do the infrastructure bill and your Endless Frontiers Act impact the China trade relationship? And will it affect issues that are sort of hot button, like the offshoring of jobs?
Well, I don't think it's coincidental that President Biden first wanted to have the infrastructure bill passed before he meets with Xi Jinping, to show, as he puts it, that democracy is capable of working and delivering and doing bold things. The Endless Frontiers Act just ensures that America will have leadership in the cutting edge technologies of the future. And China is, in my view, sabotaging their own industry. I mean, the fact that they basically muzzle Jack Ma because Jack Ma had the audacity to criticize the Chinese government shows the problem they have. I mean, why would you want to try to become a billionaire in China or an entrepreneur in China knowing that Xi Jinping would squash you? I think we have to speak out in moral clarity and say that the Chinese system of government is a morally inferior system, that they squash talent, that they squash human freedom, that the American system is morally better, and that people around the world should align with a morally better system of governing human society and speak very plainly about that. But I think China has a lot of problems given Xi Jinping's attitude towards human rights, towards freedom. They're basically sabotaging a lot of their tech companies.
But with how dependent we are on technology in the U.S. and also how much of us get our information online from this ecosystem that we've all learned can be, you know, sort of fallible and tricky. You talked about some very real differences between, you know, the governing philosophy of the U.S. and China, and there's definitely a productive conversation to be had about that. But if there were to be, you know, primacy in areas, whether it's 5G deployment, AI, how the information economy sort of functions, what impact do you think that would have on people's lives if there were to be primacy in those areas from an authoritarian government?
Well, I don't think they will have that primacy because I don't think their system of government is ultimately capable of long-term innovation to outstrip ours. I think they can have temporary leads, but as Xi Jinping is showing, they're destroying their own technology industry. That said, you know, we ought to be wary of it. And that's why I supported Huawei not being allowed in the United States. I think we have to be wary of Chinese-made technology becoming a system in the United States, given the privacy concerns. And we have to make sure that we're innovating and that we're innovating and then having that be the standard for the rest of the world. And, you know, China is engaged, in my view, in neocolonialism in Africa, where they're basically buying up a lot of these countries' resources and they're selling their own system. We have to provide an alternative.
I would like to go back to the Endless Frontiers Act. And I know that, you know, Vannevar Bush championed the idea of basic research, research for curiosity's sake, that's in the national interest. You know, work that had been regarded by many, as he said, of not even being of impact, had really been critical to producing the bomb that ended the war, and also caused a lot of suffering and was very consequential. So I think the bottom line is that basic research can really be transformative in our lives in ways that are hard to predict, but that are positive. And I know that your bill would create a new technology director at the National Science Foundation to fund applied technology and research at the late stages of development, more so than the type of basic research that we were talking about. So I'm curious if you could speak about that shift and if and why you think, you know, whether there are risks in moving away from basic toward applied research.
Well, the bill actually still will fund basic research and it increases funding for basic research. But what we say is that you need applied research as well. And this actually came out of a conversation with President Reif at MIT. And President Reif said that you need applied research to have theoretical advances. I mean, very few people are Albert Einstein. If you're Albert Einstein, you don't need applied research and you can do everything on a piece of paper to have the specific or general theory of relativity. But you also probably don't need an NSF grant if you're Albert Einstein. But for most Nobel laureates in scientific research, they need a lab, they need the applied actual experimentation to refine the theoretical. So this is a dynamic process that actually leads to advances in science. And then second, if we're going to be spending public funds, we want to make sure that the theoretical also helps the pragmatic and gives us America an edge over China in economic development, in national security. And so this tech directorate is supported by Caltech's president, MIT's president, a lot of the leading scientists. It wasn't supported, by the way, by House science staffers because of the bureaucracy. But fortunately, the political leadership, President Biden, Senator Schumer said, no, I mean, we're not going to be stifled by some staff bureaucrats. We're going to do this, and we prevailed.
So I want to turn back also to the substance of some of the things that are in the bill and the impact that they'd have on the economy. I know that the Progressive Caucus, you know, champions policies for a fair economy, but research and development hubs can also be some of the most intensely unequal communities in the country. So I was wondering if the endless, you know, do you believe the Endless Frontiers Act has improved on past economic development programs to ensure that it doesn't exacerbate those types of inequalities in our system?
Well, I think wealth generation is a good thing. I mean, if you have a community that doesn't have wealth generation and now you bring wealth generation in the modern economy, that's a good thing. And we shouldn't say, well, let's not have wealth generation there because it may be unequal. The challenge, though, and one of the biggest inequalities is regional. And so many regions have been left out of the modern wealth generation and need to have opportunities for wealth generation. Democrats also should be for equality of opportunity of wealth generation, not just redistribution post-production. So this is going to give everyone an opportunity to participate in creating and producing things in a modern economy. That said, you're very right to worry about the disparities that take place within these ecosystems. We see that in tech hubs across the country. You have cost of living go up, housing costs go up, and working class wages often don't go up. And that's why it's important to have strong unions. It's to have strong wages for the service sector. It's important to have strong housing supply so that you have housing prices not exceed wages. And it's important that we have a diversity in terms of race and gender. And those are things that are all worked into Endless Frontiers, at least the diversity of opportunity. And Endless Frontiers needs to be coupled with the president's other agenda, the PRO Act, the support for unions and the Build Back Better bill. And that's why it's just one piece of the president's holistic vision.
So I'd also be interested to know, you know, I know you have five Republican co-sponsors on the bill. So, you know, at a time when gridlock and acrimony seem worse than ever, how have you built relationships across the aisle in this moment?
On the power of the idea. I mean, I try not to be personal in my attacks with colleagues, so that helps. But largely, this is something that many people believe in. We have to make sure America leads in the 21st century. The president ended his speech today saying today will mark the first step in America winning the 21st century and being the competitive leader of the 21st century. And that's a message that's not partisan. I don't know a single Democrat or Republican who doesn't believe America should lead the 21st century as opposed to China or any other country. And if you believe that, then you have to invest in the technologies, the critical technologies that are going to allow that. And so this is an area what matters is, do you care about America winning? And that's not a Democrat or Republican thing.
In addition to the negotiations between the parties on the infrastructure bill, there are also a lot of conversations happening within the Democratic Party, of course, about Build Back Better and bigger priorities. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. What's it like working in Congress under President Biden, given his negotiating style?
He's very gracious. He spends a lot of time listening to lawmakers. We had a meeting with him in the Oval Office, 10 progressives, and he spent 2.5 hours. I said, I get bored and frustrated talking to my fellow colleagues for 2.5 hours. He has a tremendous patience. And I think that's because he was a senator for so many years. So he's a consensus builder. He's very, very likable. And I guess, you know, people say, well, why was there so much bickering and how hard was it? But that's how democracy works. That's how democracy is supposed to work. People from different regions with strong viewpoints, but ultimately we compromised. We came to a consensus. And I think actually that showed the democratic process. Now, what's sad is it was largely a democratic process where the Democrats were playing and the Republicans just, you know, didn't want to participate. They didn't want to play the game. So it's democracy, messy democracy with one party and, you know, 13 brave Republicans in the House. I wish that Republicans were willing to play and engage in the democratic process.
Yeah. And I mean, the acrimony gets a lot of the attention, but I worked in Congress for 10 years. And just like you talked about building those relationships on the strength of the ideas, you know, I worked for Democrats, but it was almost a joke in my office that all my friends were Republican because, you know, Democrats were in the minority party and we were trying to work with them to get things done. And a lot of people didn't see how productive it is, exactly as you said, that when you have ideas and the strength of these ideas that you can rally around, that you really actually can build consensus. So you mentioned, you know, the process. I know, again, you have five Republican co-sponsors on this bill. What ideas and what values were most sort of crucial to those conversations and that you were able to rally around?
American leadership in technology, American leadership over China, American leadership in innovation. Second, this idea of economic development in regions that have been left out. There's an understanding that large parts of the country face deindustrialization. Large parts of the country have been left out, that we can't just have modern economic wealth generation in Silicon Valley, Boston, Austin, and that there could be a coalition of left out communities in the Midwest and the South that deserve an opportunity, deserve a potential for having a chance at participating in the modern economy. These were principles that I don't think are partisan and attracted broad support.
So looking at Congress, you know, you've been there for some time and you've seen a lot of big things come together. If you could change any one thing about the institution, a rule, a process that you think would be a change for the better, what would it be?
The way we get elected, I mean, the campaign finance is a huge issue. It takes up members' time. It has a lot of special interests involved. That would be number one. I guess number two is I would decentralize power more. I mean, I think that the power is still disproportionately concentrated in the hands of leadership and committee chairs. And the more we can decentralize power, the better I think the chances of breaking gridlock and having new ideas emerge.
And you mentioned about the way people are elected in campaign finance. You know, I personally really did not like the series House of Cards. I thought it was totally unrealistic about how Congress works. But in The Wire, there are these scenes where Mayor Carchetti is doing these campaign finance calls and he just absolutely can't stand doing it. And I think a lot of people don't get visibility into that. So I appreciate that you said about how campaign finance could be a good thing to change. So turning to, you know, the other big piece of legislation that's before the House, the Build Back Better bill, where a lot of President Biden's priorities reside, Democrats are still working amongst themselves to figure out the path forward. And I know that there's still no score yet from the CBO for what it will cost, which is what some members had insisted on. So do you have any concerns that once the scores come out that moderate members might vote no and not want to pass this into legislation?
I don't think so. I believe the moderate House members will vote yes. I think they may push for some cuts here and there, but I don't think they will be the issue. I do have concern about whether it'll pass the Senate. And there we've taken a leap of faith, trusting the president. President wants it to pass, but that will be a challenge. And I'm optimistic he will prevail. But the Senate is the much harder institution. The House, I'm confident the speaker will get it through.
One thing I want to turn also to is inflation. I know that, you know, traditionally when people, Americans think about the economy, they also are concerned about inflation. The pandemic supply chain bottlenecks are also affecting prices. But we're also in a time of high spending and low taxes and low interest rates. So do you think government policy has helped to cause the inflation that we're seeing?
No, I think the reality is COVID has caused the inflation. A lot of the spending was under Trump. It wasn't under Biden, almost $3 trillion if it was under Trump. But there's no doubt that gas prices are high, that milk and egg prices are high, that the president and Congress need to do what we can. I've called for tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I've said we should have American oil companies not export oil right now so that they can produce this for domestic consumption so that the price of gas will come down. I've said the president should look at bold action on the ports, even considering putting the National Guard or Army Corps of Engineers out in the ports to speed up the supply, and that we ought to be looking at the Department of Agriculture, what we can do cooperatively with our farmers and ag companies to reduce the price of milk and eggs. But we need to, you know, this is on top of mind. I was back home for a week. People's wages haven't kept up, unfortunately, with some of the costs, and we have to address it.
Before we go to audience Q&A, and we have some great people here, some wonderful people who have questions, I wanted to ask you, I understand that you ran for Congress multiple times. So we're talking to someone who loves the job and really wanted it and ran for it. And I can imagine it must have been discouraging, but it's really cool that you did. So I was wondering, what was it like to run multiple times before you won your seat?
Well, it's something that people should realize is often the case. Very few people win in their first time out. And for me, the first run was a protest against the war in Iraq. I'm very proud of that run. It was one of the first anti-war candidacies. Then I didn't run for 10 years. I worked in the administration. I worked in a number of different capacities in public service, and then took a shot again, and then had a close race, but lost. My wife was good enough to say to run one more time. So my experience, and a lot of my colleagues who are in Congress that could probably vouch for this, that the biggest quality is persistence. Because when you run multiple times, people know you really want to serve. They see you're going to stick with it. And so that's what I've found resonate.
How did serving in the executive branch change your thoughts on serving in the legislative branch and on legislating?
That was a phenomenal experience serving at the Department of Commerce. I got to go around the country to meet manufacturers. It led to writing a book on the resilience of manufacturing. I understood the economics much better. And it gave me a much deeper depth on economic issues. I guess it also has given me an appreciation for the role of the executive agencies and executive branch of government along with Congress. I mean, Congress can write the laws, but ultimately then it's the executive branch that has to implement it. And that perspective informs how we write the legislation. It informed how I wrote Endless Frontiers because I understood commerce. I wanted commerce to oversee the tech hubs and had a lot of concerns about where commerce could do a good job, where it wasn't doing a good job. So that experience obviously informed how I helped write the legislation with colleagues.
So now we're going to turn to the audience Q&A part. That's part of the magic of what we do here in live social audio is that we can do this and have these conversations. Everyone, as you know, the rules are please be respectful and please be short because we have some great folks on stage with some great questions. So first, I would like to offer a chance for Peter, my co-moderator here. Peter, would you like to ask a question? Or would you like us to go right on to the audience?
Yeah, I'll shoot. So Congressman Connick, it's great to have you here. I actually grew up in your district near the warm. I lived in Milpitas near the Warm Springs district. So,
oh, wonderful. Yeah.
So I imagine you have the best, dim sum in the nation. I want to pull on the threads of economic equality and, the challenges in a lot of places that have a lot of tech industry, which is, and I imagine this is people in, I'm in Palo Alto right now. You know, the tech industry, like you said, has brought a lot of opportunity, innovation. People can see a lot of that. But at the same time, a lot of the neighboring industries and people that, we rely on for our everyday lives, they're kind of feeling the squeeze as well. So how can you what is your way of looking at making sure that, like you're saying, you can have pro-growth policies that also really tackle the, let's say, challenge with gentrification, the challenges with just equity within our current system?
Well, the equity and gentrification problems are so significant, and particularly in our area. One of the things we need is much more housing and affordable housing. I mean, many people can't live in the Bay Area. They can't afford to live with the rents. And so we need to increase the housing supply and particularly affordable housing. We need to have stronger unionization, in my view, so that the working class or the service workers get paid the wage that they deserve so that their families can live there. We need greater diversity in the tech economy. Right now, the economy is exclusive of too many people based on race and gender. In fact, in candor, I was critical of Clubhouse because I thought that this app, Clubhouse, has been too exclusive of on gender and racial lines and has to do a much better job of participating, of having inclusive conversation. So that's a broader issue for the Valley. And these are all things that we need to work on for greater equity.
I appreciate that last comment. And that's exactly the way that I felt my first week on this app. And I'm glad that I was able to find Justin and the others who are here and put together what we've done here at Politics and Media 101 to try to, create a space for people to have productive conversations. We've had incredible guests come on, and Congressman, we're grateful to you for being here. So going on next to the audience, I would be interested to hear from Rick. Rick, do you have a question for the Congressman?
Yeah, one of the things that I'm really interested in finding out, and I can't really get a lot of information, is now that the infrastructure bill has passed, how long does it take to actually get distributed to the states? And, when will we see the first jobs being created? And I know that that's a very tough question to answer, but how soon do you think we'll be seeing some real benefits as far as jobs go and as far as people seeing what the benefits of the infrastructure bill?
It's a great question. It's something that we have to do because you're absolutely right. It's not the signing ceremony that people will ultimately respond to. It's actually having the money get to the states, them seeing bridges, roads, airports being improved, them seeing broadband coming to their communities. Fortunately, the president has appointed Mitch Landrieu, really someone I deeply admire, former mayor of New Orleans, to oversee the whole process. He, I think, will really do a great job in making sure that the money gets out there fast, gets out there without waste. And I anticipate over the next few months, you're going to start seeing projects begin under his leadership.
Thank you so much. And I've really enjoyed this forum.
Thank you. And exactly like that. I mean, you know, we've had more than 250,000 people come in and out of these rooms. And what we've done is get specifically into the section by sections of what's in these bills and of, you know, get between. Usually, I think on TV, you get one or two sentences. But what we can do on Clubhouse here, including directly with the congressman himself, is run down a list of what's in the bills and talk about things in greater detail in a respectful way. So thanks for the question, Rick. Thanks for the answer, Congressman. So next, I would like to go to Ab, and then after Ab, we'll go to Andrea. Ab, what would you like to ask the congressman?
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Congressman, for joining us and giving us your time. Been a wonderful conversation. My question to you is, I see that, and I've done some research on the Endless Frontiers Act. I see that the bill was at least one that passed. Was after revisions in terms of the way that it's financed. Are you happy with the way that it's with the bill and its current construction? And two, do you have any hesitations in terms of, I know we've spoken to a great deal about addressing inequality and things of that nature, but is there any possible concern on your behalf that the same communities that we're trying to look out for could possibly be left behind due to the fact that our education system is not necessarily preparing us for the tech literacy or preparing us to have the tech literacy that is necessary for these technologies that will be developed through this act and hopefully through more R&D funding in the future? And that's pretty much it. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate that. I'll be shameless and plug my own book that comes out, Dignity in a Digital Age, because it's all about this. And I make the point that we're going to have 25 million digital jobs in 2025, which is more than manufacturing and construction jobs combined, about 13 million manufacturing jobs, 12 million construction jobs. That's a lot of jobs. And those jobs, 25 million jobs, are $80,000 median wage, twice the median wage of U.S. jobs. The question is, how do we have access to these jobs? And that requires the right type of training and education. It doesn't require a four-year degree. It often requires a nine-month course. It often requires a year-long course. But it requires that in collaboration with the private sector. So the Endless Frontiers has funding for both K-12 education and post-secondary education to prepare people in the skills for the tech hubs. But I think much more broadly, I'm working with Senator Manchin, actually, on a bill to create the land-grant institutions, all of the land-grant institutions, to have a digital proficiency part, a digital grant almost addendum to their charter, and to work with the private sector to have courses that are going to give people a credential that can get them employed. It's critical that we do this across the country. And it's critical in part so that young people don't leave the towns they grow up in, but can stay in their communities and get jobs and training in their communities and contribute to their hometown.
Thank you, Congressman, and thank you for the question. So I would like to go next to Andrea and then to Cami. Andrea, what would you like to ask the congressman today?
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Congressman, for your spending your time with us here on Clubhouse. So many questions, hard to choose. I would like to, I guess I'll pivot to COP26 and ask what your thoughts were on the outcome of that, the U.S. role, this stated cooperation, renewed cooperation with China, and how that all relates to the Build Back Better Act and where we stand with that. Thank you.
Well, the Build Back Better Act, I think, will be the biggest investment in climate that this country has ever made. Over $550 billion. It's going to have the methane fee. It's really focused on the good solar and wind and battery development. It doesn't have much money for CCS, which I think is problematic and has the science doesn't work. And I believe the president's going to be committed to getting to 50% reduction by 2030, both through Build Back Better and the state action and executive action. Now, I'm glad that we had some agreement with China, but so far China has just committed to 25% on reduction by 2030, which is not nearly enough. I assume that they will can be pushed to do more. And I guess the only thing we can do is we can lead and continue to ask the rest of the world to live up to that. And then at some point, we can consider a tax on carbon for imports to incentivize the rest of the world to live up to the right environmental standards.
Next, I would like to go to Cami and then to Dr. Francine. Cami, over to you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us here. It's an honor to have you here on Clubhouse, Congressman. My question is, based upon your unique view, hailing from Silicon Valley, and the fact that you've written a book offering your vision on democratizing digital innovation and building economically vibrant and inclusive communities, well, I'd love to know, from your point of view, what needs to be done to foster American innovation, especially in the area of AI machine learning, in order to remain and grow as an economic superpower in this context. In that, if you look at what's happening geopolitically, some have compared AI as a race among different regions, and those with less stringent privacy, data privacy policies are benefiting in that they have access to large data sets to train their AI algorithms and therefore can move at a faster pace. So what are your thoughts on this? And would love to know. Thank you.
Well, I agree with you that AI is going to be critical. I think at vis-a-vis China, the critical aspect is that we have to have AI that isn't as data dependent. And there's work being done at MIT on this. It's quite simple. You know, when I have kids, and when a child learns, let's say, how to say the word dog or cat, they're not fed thousands of pictures of dogs and cats before they learn that. The human brain is more complex. And Professor Tenenbaum at MIT is doing research on how can we have AI that approximates human learning, which doesn't require massive technology. In fact, it's fascinating. His work almost delves into philosophy, where Immanuel Kant, for example, thinks about the different categories that constitute human reason. And Tenenbaum is saying, well, what can we learn from that philosophy, and how can we construct the human mind AI in ways that can approximate that? Those are the things that I think the United States should be funding, because if we can develop, and we're way ahead of China on that, because if we can develop AI that's not as data dependent, that will give us a great advantage. And then we ought to be making sure that that application, that it's broadly accessible, and that we're training people for that, and that we're paying in terms of the jobs that result from that. We're paying people well. There are all these people actually who are doing temporary work in inputting information that AI uses, and they're making meager salaries, $2, $3 an hour for inputting that. I mean, not even minimum wage when you look at it. So how do we get that compensation to increase? So those are some of my thoughts off the top of my head.
That was a fascinating question. Thank you, Cami. I think when you have essentially a surveillance state that's so pervasive, the data inputs are just so vast. So I would be interested to quickly follow up then, Congressman, and ask two questions. One, could you speak to your Internet Bill of Rights, which is an idea that you put forward? And two, what do you think about progress on tech regulation right now? Is it mostly antitrust, or does the Bill of Rights have a chance?
The Bill of Rights does have a chance. I think it's obviously has to be prioritized, but people see the danger of data collection. I mean, we see this with Facebook. So simply right now, when you have Facebook saying that Instagram is hurting teenage girls, that they're having suicidal thoughts, that they're having depression, and that they're being targeted with data that Facebook's collecting in ways that are harmful. And so we should have some control over our data and not just give this over to big companies that can then use that to micro-target us, to manipulate us. And so I think both the insurrection and of January 6th and recent things about what's happening to teenagers on Instagram has led to a concern about these tech platforms. And the solutions are pretty simple. Don't require consent before you give up your data, have a fiduciary responsibility. So I'm hopeful this coming year we will get something through.
It's also a fascinating, you know, value set question, because obviously in some other places, the surveillance and data collections on the part of the state, but here in the US, it's private companies. And the question is, you know, how can the government help to define our relationship with them? So I really, again, appreciated that question. Thank you for the question and the answer. Next, I would like to go to Dr. Francine. And then after Dr. Francine, we can go to Ben. Dr. Francine?
Well, this, I can't decide whether this is a cynical question or an optimistic one, but if your bill, the Endless Frontiers bill, the Endless Frontier Act, passes, could it incorporate some of the things in the progressives, quote, soft infrastructure bill? If that doesn't pass, in other words, do you have, you know, anything to do with that soft infrastructure bill?
I think that the Build Back Better bill is something that is different and has to pass. It's a much bigger undertaking, and that's going to have the child allowance. That's going to have the $300 for every kid, for every family. It's going to have universal preschool. It's going to have childcare. That in magnitude and scope is much, much bigger than the Endless Frontiers bill. And so,
right, which is why I think you might be able to pass something even if the Build Back Better bill doesn't pass.
Yeah, I'm confident the Build Back Better bill will pass, but I think it would be hard, you know, because I think the Endless Frontiers are going to try to attach some of it to the National Defense bill, and they're going to try to attach some of it to the annual appropriation. I'm not sure that you can do that with Build Back Better, or you'd really dilute Build Back Better. So my sense is, to really get the magnitude of Build Back Better, we have to pass it as a separate bill, and we're working on doing that. But of course, if we can't get things through, I'm open to attaching it to different bills. But right now, we're focused on getting it through.
And Congressman, you know, you mentioned earlier about the quality of dialogue and about Clubhouse. And, you know, when I first came on here, the whole time I worked in Congress, I was really frustrated by text-based social media being the only option. And the way that, you know, when voters called in to me when I was a staff assistant, they were angry because of something that they'd read on Facebook that was so not the same picture that I was seeing legislatively on the Hill. And so when we first came on Clubhouse, one of the things I was totally enchanted by was this voice-to-voice format where there's, you know, it brings something back in terms of empathy. And based on that, you know, we've had over 250,000 people here in Politics and Media 101. And a lot of that, I would say, I would graciously now at this point thank and yield the floor to the founder of the app, Paul, who has joined us. Paul, thank you for being here. Thank you for the opportunity to do what we've done here on Politics and Media 101. What would you like to ask or share with the congressman today?
Oh, man, thank you so much. You know, I don't want to take the space from other people here on stage. I just wanted to just pop up and say thank you so much to Congressman Connor for being here, and to you and the whole Politics and Media 101 team for hosting the conversation. I, as you know, I love this club and the rooms that are hosted here. And I couldn't agree more with what you're saying about the need for more discourse. I think we, looking back at like the 2020 presidential election, there's so many rooms where you had far left liberals in the rooms with Trump voters, and they're talking as humans, right? And they're pushing each other, they're trying to understand each other. And I just love the idea that Clubhouse could be a place where people running for office could talk with the citizens, where elected officials could talk with their constituents. And so I'm just really grateful that this room is happening, and just wanted to say a big welcome and thank you so much for being here to Congressman Khanna.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate obviously your efforts. I do think we need more depth in when we talk about social media and political discourse. I saw Mark Andreessen, who I really respect, that he was quoting some passage from Socrates saying, well, the oral communication is better than written communication. I was talking to a philosophy professor about that, and they started laughing. And they said, well, if that was the case, why wouldn't we just have oral communication in classrooms Obviously, we have written assignments because sometimes we want people to think and refine their thought before they express themselves. And so it's not that oral communication is sometimes not better, but sometimes written communication is better. And the reason I point that out is I think there has been this sense that, well, let's just have these platforms and let's have everyone talk and we're going to have peace and understanding. Not saying Clubhouse has that view. And if that were the case, you know, you wouldn't need Jurgen Habermas writing thousands of pages on what the ideal forms of discourse are, or Nancy Fraser criticizing Habermas, saying that Habermas's theory is exclusive on gender and doesn't include marginalized groups. My point is just to say that there are people who've spent their lives and hundreds of years of philosophy of thinking about the conditions of discourse that are going to lead to better deliberation and better inclusive democracy. And tech needs to have a lot more humility in thinking about what their role is as stewards of democracy. And I think, frankly, I think we need, you know, more philosophy, more ethics in helping construct these platforms. I applaud you for what you've done. And I say this not about Clubhouse, but more generally to think about how we have better deliberation in this country.
Wow. Thank you so much. I think we need an applause feature for this room. I have so much I could say about that. Exactly what you're describing. People don't realize that the move to written communication was a controversial one. And there's so much that's been written about this. There's this great book, The Information by James Glick, that talks a lot about how society has evolved as our forms of discourse have evolved. Again, I don't want to take up space in this room, but I'm just grateful to be here and would love to yield the floor, let others chime in. But thank you again.
Well, that was great. I would say, imagine if all we had was text messages and then someone invented a magical machine where you could actually hear back from the person immediately and get an instant response, it would feel like a step forward. So for me personally, it felt a little bit regressive, and that's why we're happy to be here on Clubhouse. So thanks for that exchange. That was great. Next, I think we're going to go to Ben and then to Andy. Ben, what would you like to ask the congressman today?
Hi, thanks, Jeff. And hello, congressman. I have sort of an interesting situation because I'm married to a Brazilian diplomat. And although I'm from California, I've been living first in Uruguay and most recently in Burkina Faso, which is where I live now. And I have seen forms of democracy both in South America and in West Africa. And West Africa in particular has had a bunch of coups going on, two in Mali, one in Guinea, one in Sudan. And democracy is a real, you really get a viewpoint of how lucky we are in America. Although recently with our own coup, I've been very concerned. And just how we are getting the past 4 years, the previous years, we're getting so close to the other authoritarian like Brazil, like Turkey, Hungary. So what I want to ask you is about H.R. 1, S1, the For the People Act, because I know we've been doing all of the infrastructure stuff, which I think is great. But the thing is that the one thing that we need more than anything right now, everything that we've just done will be just for naught if we don't get the H.R. 1 passed now as soon as possible, because the gerrymander did everything is up to that. So my question to you is, what are you and the Congress doing now with H.R. 1 and S1 to get rid of the filibuster and pressure that to get going, because that needs to be done sooner than later? And the second question is, what can we as citizens do to put pressure on the to get this passed immediately, because for me that is the single most important thing right now. Thank you.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's important into the type of democracy we're going to have, and if a democracy is exclusive of some of our citizens based on their economic status or race, that's deeply problematic morally. And if our democracy is gerrymandered, that's problematic. So there's a substantive reason. I mean, this is the most important thing for democracy, and a political reason. If we don't do this, you're basically allowing the Republicans to rewrite the rules. The president has said once his agenda passes, it's going to be his highest priority, his economic agenda. So I anticipate that he's going to increase pressure on the Senate to move without the 60 votes, to have a filibuster exception to voting rights. And all of the folks who care about this should make sure that that's the case. I mean, we don't need more press conferences saying let's have voting rights. We don't need more speeches. We need simply everyone saying that we have to do this without the filibuster and getting people on board to do it, at least on voting rights.
Thank you, Congressman, and thank you for the question. So next, let's go to Andy, and then we'll go to Karen. Andy, over to you.
Thanks, Jeff. Many thanks for your time today, Congressman. Really great to hear from you. My question comes from the background here in the UK, where Brexit is causing considerable turmoil in research programs and future funding and future cooperation. In terms of the Enders Frontier Act, which obviously has a lot to say in setting America's goals to be ahead in order to combat China, how would you say it stands in terms of having America also play and conduct joint research around the world with its allies? Many thanks.
Well, I think there's definitely an opportunity for the United States to have research with our allies and research advancing human knowledge, even with non-allies, where it's appropriate to have advancement of science. And this is something that American institutions have always led with. I have a separate bill, which is bipartisan, with Ed Markey and Tom Cotton on working on scientific collaboration with Taiwan, particularly on health issues, where they've done a tremendous job on COVID. Now, they have some civil liberties issues that we would be problematic here, but by and large, they've done a good job there. So we ought to be learning and collaborating from allies that are engaged in scientific leadership. None of our funds in the Endless Frontiers go towards that, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be supplemental efforts once America is leading to facilitate that kind of collaboration.
Thank you. Let's go to Karen, and then we'll go to Ali. Karen?
Yes, thank you so much for this forum. And Ben took my voting question. So I will follow up with a police justice question. You know, we have these competing trials now going on in terms of Black Lives Matter. And what do you think as citizens that we can do to help support legislation that would make police more accountable and other situations like that? Thank you.
We have a legislation drafted by Karen Bass, Justice and Policing Act, that passed the House, and it was very balanced. It said, obviously, we respect law enforcement, but law enforcement needs to have accountability. They shouldn't use force unless it's a last resort. They shouldn't use chokeholds, and they should be diversified. They should have training. And that has stalled in the Senate. So what we need is, again, that's filibuster is the reason. We need either 51 senators through getting rid of the filibuster to pass it, or we need some leadership that gets Republicans on board. But there haven't been any Republicans really willing to support that. And the challenge on that has just been stalled. It's just been stalled in the Senate.
Thank you very much.
Let's go next to Max. Max, what would you like to ask the congressman today?
Hi, Congressman. I wanted to take it back to U.S.-China competition, particularly in the context of our showdown with Iran over the nuclear program. One thing that became very clear contrasting the Trump and Obama administration's approaches to this issue is that you're not going to be able to have an effective strategy on Iran without China's help, both in enforcing sanctions. We've seen that, you know, despite the U.S. applying all these unilateral sanctions, China has continued to buy Iranian oil, which means that, you know, while we in the U.S. are paying close to $4 a gallon, China is getting super cheap gasoline, which isn't great in terms of, you know, U.S.-China competition. But more broadly in that, if the negotiations fail and it ends up back in the Security Council and the U.S. decides to try to invoke snapback, we need China to honor it. And it seems that the most important way forward would be for us to actually do that and challenge China to either side with the U.S. in what we call this rules-based international order, or side with Iran in flouting international norms. So just want to see if you've pressed the administration. I know you speak with Rob Malley from time to time. Have you pressed them to try and get an answer from China on exactly what the U.S. would need to do before they would consider us, you know, back in the deal, a participant in the deal?
Well, very thoughtful points. I mean, this is why what Trump did was so destructive, because the president, President Obama, had gotten China on board in the original Iran deal, and that was a no small feat. And it's going to be very difficult to do it again. But you're right that if China doesn't participate, it really decreases our leverage over Iran. I know the administration, Jake Sullivan and others, are very conscious of this, and have emphasized this in the bilateral negotiation with China. My sense is that what China says is first get Iran to even agree to a deal. So our first step is to get Iran. And I think the administration is confident if we do get Iran that they can prevail on China. But it's going to be harder to do given what Trump did.
Thank you. Excellent question. Excellent answer. We are going to go last to Ali for a question, and then we'll go back to the congressman for his final thoughts. Ali?
Hi. Well, thank you, Congressman Rukana, for joining. And a question I had is, well, you know, one source of money for investing in tech in a positive way is, of course, government investment in tech and innovation. Another is, you know, private investment from, say, Silicon Valley. But, you know, a lot of the private investment in Silicon Valley, as far as I can tell, you know, it seems to go to a lot of things that, like, you know, like Theranos and, you know, exploitative gig work type companies. What can or should government do to make investment coming, you know, private investment into tech geared more towards, say, helping workers and advancing America technologically for the long term?
Well, this is where I think you need a public role. I mean, venture capital is there for the last stage of commercialization, and the public investments are there for a long-term disruptive innovation that may not have an immediate market return. Now, I think there has been a lot of good funding for venture capital as well. I mean, they funded things like Apple and Google and a lot of companies that have had a lot of value, though they may have problems. It's not that all of the VC funding has been on negative efforts. But, you know, to the extent your point is that VC funding, we need to think about how to diversify it so that it is also taking bets on high capital intensive projects, because a lot of the VC money goes on low capital intensive projects. I think that would happen if there was some public support for capital projects and the public-private partnerships to do that, or incentives to do that. And then we ought to be figuring out how do we diversify VC money that is still very much going to regionally, you know, specific areas, 50% of it almost in the Bay Area, my district, and Massachusetts, New York, not geographically spread out, and that has huge issues on race and gender. I mean, less than 2% goes to African-American entrepreneurs and very little money going to women entrepreneurs. So we have to think about how we incentivize a greater diversity of those investments.
So, Congressman, you've been very generous with your time. You've been with us for almost a full hour. We've had great audience question and answers. Everyone in the audience, again, please go to pm101.live. We have a bunch of podcasts up. We're going to be putting this one up as well. So before you leave tonight, Congressman, are there any last thoughts that you would like to leave us with? Also, our global audience, we've had about 3,000 people here tonight. It could be something good, something bad, or something in between.
Well, the central challenge, in my view, what I write about in Dignity and Digital Age and a lot of the work I've been doing is how do we democratize access to the digital economy? I mean, to me, this is critical for our democracy. My district has $11 trillion of market value, my district and the surrounding Silicon Valley areas. Think about that. It's the most wealth generated probably in human history. And yet you have so many parts of this country, rural America, that have had stagnant wages, a racial wealth gap of 10-1 in Black and brown communities. And you're not going to solve the racial wealth gap unless you solve the racial wealth generation gap. You can't have that gap reduced if people are excluded from the wealth generation of the modern economy. So we have to figure out how do we get the opportunities for modern wealth generation into rural America, into places that were deindustrialized, into Black and brown communities, where young people have the same ambition to succeed, but don't have necessarily the opportunities or capital. And we've had some successes with that. We partnered with Representative Clyburn at Claflin University. We've done things. I've done things with Governor Reynolds at Jefferson, Iowa, with Al Rogers in Appalachia. But we need more of that, I think. So it will connect our country, too. So there's more of a connectivity. And I guess my final point is what America is trying to do is very difficult. There has never been a multiracial, multiethnic democracy in the history of the world. And so the idea that it would be a linear line from Obama onwards was probably naive. But I'm very optimistic over the long trajectory that we will get there. We will get there where if we can empower people who have been left out both economically and to participate as citizens in our democracy. And that's why I appreciate Clubhouse and particularly appreciate the more that we can do on Clubhouse to make it racially and gender inclusive.
It appears that is all we have for you today. Huge thanks to Congressman Khanna for coming out, to our audience for their questions, and to you for being here. As always, if you like or dislike what you hear, if you want to find out how to join us live almost every day of the week, or maybe ask one of our upcoming guests a question, please visit our website, pm101.live or pm101.club. They both work and will get you to the same place where you can find all that and more. This has been Politics and Media 101. I'm Jeff Browning on behalf of Justin Higgins, our co-founder, and our team. Thank you very much for being here. We hope to see you and hear from you soon.